U.S. Coast Guard has closed the Illinois River to all traffic due to big flooding, including a major levee breach this past weekend. We'll get the latest on floods in southwestern Illinois. Plus, many Americans can't afford a lawyer to help with their civil cases, but the Ask a Lawyer desk is here to help. The organization behind it is coming to Champaign County tomorrow. And U of I and Northwestern have teamed up to form Illinois' first database dedicated to twins and their genetic makeup.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, we're going to check in on communities that have been affected by heavy flooding from the Illinois and Mississippi rivers. And if you're facing civil legal issues but can't afford a lawyer, the Ask a Lawyer desk is offering help for those who need it. We'll get into that and more this hour. We've been hearing a lot about the return of measles into the U.S. It's one of the many preventable diseases we associate with another time, but that are actually back on the rise, according to public health officials. One other example, syphilis. The sexually transmitted disease can cause serious neurological damage. It can even be fatal, but it's completely treatable and curable. The new battleground for the disease is actually rural counties across the West and the Midwest. Here in Illinois, cases have increased almost three times in a decade, with a third of those cases outside of Chicago. Lauren Weber has been reporting on this for Kaiser Health News, where she's the Midwest correspondent, and she joins us now. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us from Springfield is Dr. Vidya Sundaresan, an associate professor at SIU Medicine and an infectious diseases specialist. Dr. Sundaresan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Lauren, in your article, you focused on Missouri, and I want to talk about that in a minute. But first, I wonder if we can discuss what's happening here in Illinois. As you look at the data, what have you learned about syphilis cases in Illinois over the past 15 years?
If you look at the data in Illinois, first off, it's 10th out of 50 states when it comes to syphilis, which isn't necessarily that much of a surprise considering Chicago. You know, syphilis is usually really concentrated in more urban areas, and considering Chicago's size, that makes sense to some degree. But since 2008 to 2017, cases of syphilis have nearly doubled, almost tripled. You've gone from, for primary and secondary syphilis, you've gone from 554 cases to 1,225. In that time, you know, from 2014 to 2018, funding to fight syphilis to the Illinois, state of Illinois, has decreased. Overall, STD prevention funding has gone from $4.3 million to $4.1 million. And when you look at it, I think what's interesting, and as I point out in my story, and as we're seeing really broadly across the Midwest and West, you're seeing these cases pop up more and more and kind of diffuse more and more outside of these urban centers where there's frankly more infrastructure and more knowledge around combating it. So in Chicago, you know, back in, I believe it was 2014, you had 2008, you had 129 cases that were outside of Chicago. Now you have 437. And that's,
Wow. That's
more than a third of your state's cases are now taking place outside of your major urban area. When you look at Missouri, I think it's a little even worse there. You've got almost 45% taking place outside of their major cities. And I think Chicago, if you look at syphilis in general, a map of syphilis rates over the years, it's kind of a U shape. It's the coasts and the south predominantly, and it's almost like a net. And so I think we're seeing this trend where it continues to kind of rise north and diffuse into these states in the Midwest and West that have kind of been the last grounds that haven't seen this explosion of cases as much. And it makes sense to me that Illinois is maybe, you know, a year or two behind what we're seeing in Missouri and Oklahoma and some of these other states, because it's the way that the net is kind of catching up, it would be one of the last ones to see this reflection.
So we're going to get into reasons for why this is happening, how you treat this. But Dr. Sundaresan, you work in and around Springfield. Is what Lauren's saying, are you seeing this among the communities you're serving? What kind of numbers are you seeing?
Absolutely. There has been a spike in the numbers that we see here in our clinics and in the local public health departments as well. There are multiple reasons, and as Lauren pointed out correctly, there has been a decrease in funding. So that amounts to lesser resources for education for people at risk, the staff that is taking care of patients that present with symptoms, to help them identify these early, to be able to counsel them effectively, for all that resources are needed. Syphilis is a reportable condition, so all the labs that are positive for a syphilis test get notified. The public health departments get notified. They're supposed to by law within 7 days. We do have a better way of screening, better way of reporting, and that kind of may account for a little bit of an increase too. But in addition to that, I would also say for heterosexual behaviors, use of IV drugs has gone up too. Methamphetamine particularly, which was also reported by CDC recently. So use of IV drugs increases the sexual risk behaviors, which have led to an increased overall risk and increase in syphilis as well as other STIs. Partner services, people need to use that more, know how to use them. Inconsistent condom use, concurrent sexual partnerships, and then also a general stigma that's associated with STIs and HIV, all that has also led to decreased utilization of healthcare resources and services.
So, Dr. Sundaresan, I mean, when we think about the opioid epidemic, you're saying that this plays a part in this as well, when we're thinking not just about STIs in general, but in this case, maybe even the spread of syphilis?
Well, because the risk factors are essentially the same. You have an increased chance of high-risk behavior with the use of IV drug use. So as the other STIs increase, syphilis correspondingly increases as well.
And then apart from that, I wonder what populations you're seeing in Springfield. You mentioned at-risk populations. Who would that be?
So mainly reported are men. Having sex with men, that's the predominant high numbers or high-risk population that we see. But we have also seen an increase in pregnant women, particularly in our clinics. We have seen with the screening that has improved, there has been a slight increase in that number. And heterosexual risk people at risk, again, with use of IV drug use.
Lauren, when we're thinking about the at-risk populations, and I wonder when we're also thinking about rural communities, what are some challenges here when we're thinking about people, first of all, recognizing that they have syphilis and then also getting treated?
I mean, there's many, right? I mean, look, syphilis is commonly known as the great imitator. It's difficult necessarily to diagnose, especially if you haven't seen very many cases. And in some of these more rural areas where there might be more stigma around sexual partners, multiple sexual partners, or men having sex with men, that, you know, that adds to treatment difficulties. You know, I know for my story in Missouri, you know, we had one patient who was told, oh, honey, only hookers get syphilis, from their local provider. So there certainly is, I mean, still to this day, a lot of stigma around STDs and STIs that, you know, prohibits some treatment. And on top of that, you know, like I said, it's called the great imitator, and you have these areas in these more rural communities that haven't seen cases of syphilis anytime recently. It's not necessarily top of mind as something that you would diagnose. And I think that that is playing into some of this, you know, rise, because people don't necessarily catch it, and then they spread it to other folks.
And so when we're seeing communities, I know our producers were reaching out to different public health departments. And I know in Wabash County, they told us they didn't have any cases for 9 years. And then they had 3 cases all in 1 year. Are we seeing cases having anything in common in terms of how this is spreading?
I mean, I would say that there is, you know, I don't necessarily know if it's something in common. I think the doctor pointed out as well, the drug use risk factor is something that we're certainly seeing playing into a lot of folks that have, you know, reported that they have syphilis. I think another thing is we're seeing an increase, and I believe it was in this Wabash County, they talked about how those three patients potentially had a link to a dating app. And, you know, in my conversations with public health experts, one of the new challenges for public health officials, which, you know, one of them told me was that, you know, you can't just get into Grindr. It's difficult. You know, the days of sitting at the local bar and kind of seeing how an STD could travel are gone. You know, there's a lot more access to more sexual partners through somewhat more anonymized apps. So it can contribute to more difficulty in finding and informing partners that they may have been exposed.
Dr. Sudarshan, I wonder, to Lauren's point about doctor education, what you think it looks like among the medical population outside of big cities like Chicago or St. Louis in terms of making sure that doctors are informed about knowing how to treat this. I imagine this would be primary care doctors. It would be really important for them to be aware of this, correct?
Absolutely. So primary care, a lot of times patients seek help in the emergency room too, because many of them are young, they don't really have primary care physicians. So the first line or the first point of contact would be in an emergency room situation as well. So increased education is very important. And, you know, with syphilis, like Lauren was pointing out, it is a great imitator. It can present with many symptoms, and there are multiple stages of syphilis, and there are different symptoms for different stages. To be able to identify that, you need to have seen adequate numbers. The primary syphilis or the initial presentation is with a painless ulcer. A lot of times the patients themselves do not notice it because it's painless.
Is that an ulcer, you said?
Yeah, a painless ulcer. So, and since it does not have any pain, it does not even catch the attention of the patient. So, there are multiple manifestations of the disease, and primary syphilis can be easily missed, was what I'm trying to say.
Once it's contracted, what are the risk factors for people in terms of what can happen to you?
So once it is contracted, it needs to be treated appropriately. And it's a very simple treatment. It's one rather painful injection of penicillin, but it is very effective. This is one organism which can easily be treated with penicillin, and we haven't seen drug resistance. So that's a blessing. And then if we are able to diagnose patients in secondary syphilis or latent or a later stage of syphilis, then it may be 3 injections. If somebody presents with neurosyphilis, neurologic manifestations, it may be an IV.
That's pretty far advanced, I imagine, at that point, right?
It is.
Lauren, so how, when we're looking at these treatments, how expensive are they, especially, I guess, at the initial level?
Well, honestly, the doctor might be better equipped to answer that one, but I do know that costs have gone up as clinics have been unable to cover some of the costs in different areas. I mean, in general, sexual health clinics, and I think this gets to kind of one of the core reasons I think behind all of this is crumbling public health infrastructure. And part of that's funding. I mean, over the last 10 years, we've seen something like, you know, even in 2012 alone, we saw 21 sexual health clinics across the U.S. close. And so, you know, you're seeing these clinics, there's less sexual health clinics, they're open less time, they don't have as many hours, they don't have as many places, and they're not able to cover as many costs. So some more of those costs are being directed back to the patients who may not want to cover those costs and so may never go get tested themselves. You know, I had folks in Missouri tell me that, you know, sometimes these shots for Bicillin would cost somewhere around $400 depending, but it really, you know, it depends, but that's a lot of money. And kind of this lack of funding and this kind of lack and spiral of crumbling public health infrastructure really all contributes to more cases, more concern, and, you know, a future that where we're going to see more of this happening.
Dr. Sundaresan, what would you like to see in terms of funding and thinking about not just education, but prevention and treatment?
So there was a national shortage of penicillin not long ago, but now that's resolved. Definitely more resources are required, and education is foremost, not only for the patients, but also for people that are going to be managing these patients. Counseling funding is, again, important, and resources and training, again, important for counseling as well. That would be another area that we should focus our attention to.
And Lauren, I wonder when we're thinking also about rural areas as specific challenges, I'm thinking particularly of when you're in maybe a smaller community, anonymity can be a difficult thing. And I wonder how much that, when we're talking about the stigma around this, that prevents people from going to their doctor in the first place.
Absolutely. I had the head of STD prevention in Missouri told me that many folks are worried about going to their local doctor's office because, you know, maybe the receptionist will talk around town, or frankly, maybe their doctor is going to call their parents. You know, I mean, it's and also maybe it's the same doctor who's also your Sunday school teacher and your soccer coach. So especially when, you know, the local provider is so integral to part of the community, which is has wonderful health benefits on that side. But for some sexually transmitted diseases, there is a lot of, you know, social stigma that still persists. And, you know, that plays into some of this.
Just before we end here quickly, Lauren, as you're continuing to report this out, what are you looking at next? I imagine the funding structure is an important part of this.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, look, I mean, from 2013 to 2018, the federal funding for STD prevention stayed flat at $157 million, but that essentially equates to a 40% decrease in purchasing power. So at the end of the day, even though the funding nationally has stayed somewhat steady with inflation, it's gone down tremendously. So, you know, as we kind of track these clinics closing, the funding really not being adequate, and the case count rising, I really think we're going to have to keep an eye on seeing where this goes.
That's Lauren Weber, a Midwest correspondent with Kaiser Health News. We've tweeted out her story. I want to thank her, along with Dr. Vidya Sundaresan, for being with us from SIU Medicine in Springfield. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we take a break, just wanted to update you on a story we talked about late last month, a judge issuing a consent decree aimed at Champaign bus company Suburban Express. The company's owner, Dennis Teppin, has been in legal trouble with the state for alleged discrimination and harassment of customers. Well, late yesterday, Teppin shut down operations altogether. Suburban Express's website is already unavailable, and the company will be dissolved, according to Teppin, no later than July 31st. The Champaign News-Gazette reports that before his website was taken down, Teppin wrote that he thinks shutting down his company will, quote, render most of the consent decree moot. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Southwestern Illinois and the Metro East area are continuing to see heavy flooding from the Illinois and Mississippi rivers. Yesterday, the Coast Guard actually closed all traffic going through the Illinois River. One county, Calhoun, which includes towns on the Illinois River, has declared a state of emergency. Governor Pritzker has also issued disaster proclamations for 34 counties along the two rivers. Local officials and community members have been working hard to keep their town safe and prepare for potentially more flooding in the near future. We're going to hear from some of those folks in a moment. But first, Hannah Muslich has been covering this. She's a breaking news reporter for the Belleville News Democrat on the line from their newsroom now. Hi, Hannah. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Hannah, I wonder if we can start with where in Illinois we're seeing the worst flooding, the heaviest flooding right now.
So from what I know, Calhoun County, which you just mentioned, declaring that state of emergency, that's where it's really bad. So Calhoun County, it sits right on the Mississippi and the Illinois. And some of where we're seeing that worst flooding is near Hardin, which is a city there. So it crested yesterday at 37.8 feet. It's in the major flooding stages that the National Weather Service considers. The sheriff's office is still asking for volunteers. I know that some high school students were helping out after school in terms of sandbagging, just making sure that they're building up those walls. I know that IDOT had sent down about 5,000 pre-made sandbags yesterday, and I'm sure those efforts are continuing. That's kind of where the worst of it is right now. From what I know, going a little bit south of that in Jersey County, Grafton, Illinois is also flooding. Grafton and Alton, those areas are kind of used to the flooding. They kind of expect it. And so that's kind of where we're seeing the biggest impact right now down here.
Hannah, you mentioned that it was starting to crest, the river. Can you remind us with the flood how oft, like, this can be a slow process, right, of the floodwaters rising and then flooding and then receding? How long are we seeing, like, how long has this process been going on, for example, in Hardin?
Well, I know that we've been looking at it since at least last month, and I've talked to the U.S. Corps of Engineers office in St. Louis, and they've told me that it's truly dependent on the weather as well. So a lot of the problems that we see in terms of the Illinois, or if you go a little bit south of that, the Kaskaskia River, which runs kind of through the state, the backing up that occurs in those rivers and what causes that flooding is not only from the Mississippi flooding and kind of backing up there, but also from the runoff from rain in other parts of the state. So whenever that comes down, those two kind of come both upstream and downstream and affect the river, and that kind of is what's causing it to go out. So we've been looking at it for about a month, kind of keeping track of that in those areas. And just this last week, over this last weekend, is when we really started to see some of that cresting into the major flooding stages.
Hannah, I also understand there was some levees. There was a levee fail that had effect on some people's water. And I wanted to ask you about Illinois American Water. They've issued a mandatory conservation order for some customers in the Metro East area. Can you explain a little bit more about how that works?
Yeah, so Illinois American Water services a lot of communities down here near Belleville, kind of the metro east of the St. Louis area. They had a levee break due to high flooding waters on Choteau Island near Pontoon Beach. And then they issued that water conservation restrictions for several of the communities down here. And that includes taking showers instead of baths, avoiding running sprinklers, washing machines, dishwashers. The main concern there is mostly to save water for sanitation purposes, for fire protection, and just kind of in general keeping water service available. As of right now, there's no boil orders or anything issued for those communities, but a lot of that does come down to what the company's telling us, at least, making sure those water conservation efforts are in place.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a head-scratcher, right, Hannah? Like, you need to be conserving water during a flood, but it's really because you're trying to conserve the cleanest water, I presume?
Yeah, that's at least what Illinois American Water is telling us. And they're still working on it. They've been working on it day and night, they said. So we're not sure when it will be fixed, you know, and when those restrictions can be lifted. But they're keeping the public in know and obviously using us kind of as a vessel for that.
Mm-hmm. And again, that's just limited to a few places in the Metro East area. We've been talking with Hannah Muslich, a breaking news reporter with the Belleville News Democrat. I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation. Blake Roderick is executive director of he's the County Farm Bureau Manager for Pike and Scott Counties. Hi, Blake. Thanks for being with us as well.
Yes, hello. I'm glad to be here.
Blake, I wonder if you can let us know what the current situation is. So you're the western part of the state. I imagine you're south of Quincy, right, where you guys are?
Just south of Quincy. Actually, it's we're about, if you take I-72 west from Springfield, we are Scott County and Pike County are right on I-72. So we're west central Illinois, and very similar to what's going on down lower part of the Illinois River, which we're still considered part of the lower Illinois. The counties that I work in, Scott and Pike, and I think some of all the counties around here have the county boards, commissioners have declared states of emergency. Oh, probably a couple weeks ago. Somewhat due to the expected rise in the Illinois River, but definitely on the Mississippi River, which right now is starting to decline. But it will crest again here in a couple, 3 days because of some of the rain that was going on upriver and in Iowa. So we have been dealing with a high water on the Mississippi River starting in October of last year. Had some top 10 type floods in October, and then again in March, and now here April, May on the Mississippi River, but it is starting to go down. The Illinois River is the main concern.
And how high is the river right now in your area, Blake?
Well, we're about 27 feet above flood stage in our area. Give you an idea, I don't know if people have been across the Illinois River on the lift bridge there at Florence. That's kind of the area where right now we're very critical situation. It's very high water. I mean, it's up almost to the top of the levees right now.
So in that case, for those bridges, for example, you're saying critical. Can people still get across the bridge at this point, though, safely?
They can still get across the bridge. And in any case, if you can get across the interstate bridge, but you can still get across the road. The road there is not closed. The road across into Missouri through U.S. 54. Is still closed because of high water. It goes from Pike County into Louisiana, Missouri. It is still closed because of high water. But they expect to have that open here next week, sometime early, hopefully next week.
Blake, I want to ask you about the farms and your farmers, but I just want to ask you before we get to farms, when we're thinking about the weather, our rainy weather, so you're saying that the rain we're getting, for example, in Iowa or in the northern part of the state is actually what's causing a lot of problems for you all downstream.
Correct. I mean, it can rain all day here, and it's going to have minimal impact on the Illinois River or the Mississippi River. It's what happens upstream, what's happening up on the Illinois River, what's happening up towards Peoria, Chicago, Ottawa, within the Illinois River watershed. High water, snow melt, those types of things cause the river to increase down here. Also, similar to what Hannah said, was when you've got the Missouri River in flood, the Mississippi River in flood, that tends the drain isn't big enough down around St. Louis to carry all that water through, so it starts backing up the Illinois River. And we faced that in the 1993 flood, and I think that's part of why we're having this high water now, is it just takes so long to drain through
the system. How is that affecting, you're the also, as I mentioned, you're the County Farm Bureau Manager, how is this affecting farmers in your area?
Well, our farmers aren't being, they're just being affected the same way as farmers across Illinois at this point.
It's just real wet. I mean, I've seen puddles across fields all over the state when I've been driving.
It was wet last fall. People could not get their fall field work done. It was remained wet, as I said, throughout the spring. As soon as it warmed up, it was wet. There's just crops aren't planted. There's concern whether or not some crops will be planted at all, in the main corn belt and soybean belt here and throughout Illinois and Iowa and Missouri and places like that, whether or not there will be fields that will be left open because they just can't get in and get them planted at this point. So it's very frustrating to farmers, particularly frustrating to those folks who are spending their time on the levees fighting the flood and can't get their crops planted even if they were able to.
Blake, we've got folks listening from all across the state. Is there anything you want people to know in terms of how they can help, if they can help?
Yeah, I think we've been seeing these floods happen over and over again. We had a flood in 13 here on the Illinois River. We had it again in 15 and in 16 and now again in 19. The farmers get out, the landowners get out, and they add a foot or so of sandbags on top of the levee just to make sure that they don't get overtopped. We really need to have some revisions in the way that Illinois fights floods, protects property and from flooding. We need to have some systemic type of changes in the rules and the regulations so that we can keep this kind of flooding from happening. It's so very important, particularly on the Mississippi River. We're seeing this, and I think at number one, when we get done with this flood fight, we have to redouble our efforts to not have to go through this again.
That's Blake Roderick. He's the County Farm Bureau Manager for Pike and Scott Counties. We wish you guys well. I want to thank Hannah Muslich for also being with us. She's been covering this for the Belleville News Democrat. Blake, Hannah, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When you hear the line, you have a right to an attorney, many don't realize that only applies to criminal cases. In civil cases, if you can't afford a lawyer, the options are limited. Sometimes people have the only option is to represent yourself. A program called Ask a Lawyer that has already been helping residents in Decatur and Peoria now is coming to Champaign County. It provides free assistance to those looking to navigate the civil legal system. Joining us for more is Michael Bergman, the executive director of the nonprofit Public Interest Law Initiative that's leading this effort. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, and thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Michael, how many people are out there that maybe need civil legal help but can't afford it in Illinois?
So there's tens of thousands of people who are trying to navigate the legal system without the assistance of a lawyer. Sometimes that's because they decide that they think they can do it on their own, but they might have the resources to do it. But in many instances, it's folks who do not have the money to pay a lawyer. And if they have to spend money on legal fees, it's going to take away from them being able to afford basic necessities. And so our Ask a Lawyer program and other efforts through PILLI are really targeted on those folks, the ones who this would be a real hardship for them to be paying an attorney and therefore are likely going to have to face the legal system on their own.
And what kind of things are people facing here? Because I think sometimes when you say civil cases, are we talking about child custody, divorce, what bankruptcy? What are we thinking about here?
All of the above and then some. It really runs the gamut. It's all kinds of family law issues, from divorce to custody to child support to visitation. It's adult and minor guardianship. It's landlord-tenant issues like eviction. It's mortgage foreclosure. It's consumer debt and fraud. It's bankruptcy. It really is a very wide range of issues. We focus on those things where the attorney wouldn't be able to collect a fee, where it's a contingent fee or there's going to be award money in the settlement. That's not what we're focusing on. We're focusing on these really basic legal issues that folks are facing that are impediments to them getting a job or maintaining their employment, to keeping their house, to keeping their family together, or really about basic safety and protection.
And so what kind of specific things do the lawyers at the desk help with, and how does this work?
So it is twice a month for 2 hours each time, and the volunteer attorney will meet with as many clients as they can during that time for up to a 30-minute period of time per client. The issues that they face are the ones that I just described, and they'll help with any of them, and it might be answering questions, trying to explain what it's going to be like to appear in front of a judge and what you can or can't do or say. It might be that you are helping explain some forms or explain a recent court order that's been entered by the court and what your obligations are. It might be talking about legal process and telling you how to go about doing the things that's required to either file a case or to respond in a case. It's that kind of stuff which is possible to do in a short setting of about a half hour. The challenge with that is that means that if we only have one volunteer attorney, and each person takes a full half hour, we might only be able to see four in one of the settings each month. But again, for these folks, the reality is that there's probably no other alternative for them. And so in our mind, getting them any help is really something. And hopefully, as the program grows in Champaign County, we might be able to add more volunteers during shifts. That's what we've been able to do in Peoria.
Okay. And in Decatur as well?
Decatur actually just launched last month, so right now they, like Champaign, will only be with one lawyer for the two shifts each month. But in Peoria, we're able to have two lawyers per shift each month. That program in Peoria has been around for quite a bit longer than what we're doing both in Macon and Champaign, which are our newest two efforts.
So are you looking for volunteers for attorneys, or are you also, and I imagine you also want to spread the word for who qualifies for help from you guys?
Sure. So we definitely are looking for volunteer attorneys, as well as volunteer paralegals and law students. The attorneys are the ones who would actually meet with the client, and then the paralegals and law students would do the intake interview that happens as step one in the process. For the clients, we also want to make sure that they know about this, and there is an income eligibility requirement. They must meet federal poverty, be within 200% of the federal poverty guidelines. And we have a chart there that kind of breaks that down, and that's part of the intake process to make sure that they qualify from that standpoint. As you described, it has to be a civil legal matter. And then the other big issue is that they aren't represented by an attorney. We're really only focused on those people who are truly self-represented.
That's Michael Berkman, Executive Director of the Public Interest Law Initiative. This Ask a Lawyer program, as he's been talking about, launched in Decatur last month, has been around in Peoria for a while. Tomorrow comes to Champaign County. We'll have more information about that up at our website at 21stshow.org. Michael, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When I say the word twins, who comes to mind? Maybe a famous set of twins like the Olsen twins or astronauts Scott and Mark Kelly? Maybe you are a twin yourself. Well, actually, 1 in 30 births in the U.S. are twin births. That's nearly 130,000 births, according to the CDC's latest numbers. And it turns out twin research, as it's often called, can tell us a lot, not just about twins, but about many different areas of life, whether we're talking about genetics, child development, or health. And for the first time, Illinois will have its own statewide database of twins, triplets, or others who want to participate and possibly help researchers with their work. It's called the Illinois Twins Project. It's being launched by Northwestern University and the University of Illinois. Jennifer Tackett is co-principal investigator of the project. She's an associate professor of psychology at Northwestern. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer, how did you first get interested in twin research?
That's a good question. I actually was really interested in personality and aggression, which is what I study, and ended up doing my PhD at the University of Minnesota, which has one of the biggest centers for twin and family research in the world. So I sort of fell into twin research, and it got me hooked, and I haven't been able to get away from it yet.
And so I mentioned we can learn a lot about other topics from twins. Why is that?
Well, twin research is a really powerful tool that allows us to start to disentangle the extent to which our genes and our environments influence the people we are in many, many different ways. So it's a great scientific platform that can be leveraged to answer lots and lots of different scientific questions.
And how does this, for example, in your work, how would you use twin research?
Well, there are lots of ways to use it as well. So there are many variations on these designs that can be pretty powerful. One of the ways it's often used is if we're interested in understanding the extent to which some of our behaviors are learned, which we would think of as an environmental process. We can think of something like the personality trait of extroversion or versus introversion. So we know from twin research that, you know, if we have a child who's extroverted versus introverted, there's a pretty substantial genetic influence on this personality trait. But we also know from twin research that as parents, we're probably not kind of teaching the child to be extroverted. So it doesn't seem to be happening through this environmental process of modeling. On the other hand, there are some behaviors we found in my research that do show this modeling effect. So an example of that is what we would call relational aggression or kind of mean girls behavior. So this sort of gossipy social exclusion kind of behavior does seem to be influenced by these learning effects, which
is
pretty powerful information.
So that's learned rather than... And then when we think about misconceptions about twins or triplets, are there any that you think are important for people to know or break down here?
I think a common misconception in terms of like the implications of twin research is the extent to which it kind of answers the nature versus nurture debate, which really isn't a debate, right? So we do know that it isn't a question of is it genes or is it environment in this kind of competitive sense. What twin research does is really look at it in a much more complex way, including the extent to which genes and environment interact in sort of this complex interplay to produce various outcomes.
So I wonder if we can get to the Illinois Twins Project. Why do you think there's important for us to have a statewide registry here in Illinois?
Well, twin registries typically exist within geographic regions. There are a few states that have them, but not very many. So there's a real opportunity to do something new here. There are a number of countries as well in other parts of the world that have pretty big twin registries. So it's pretty exciting for Illinois to have its own. One, I think, sort of fun Illinois fact is that New Trier High School actually holds the Guinness World Record for having the most multiples in the same class. I think this was a couple of years ago. They had something like 50 sets of multiples in a single class at New Trier.
Wow. So this is a suburban Chicago high school. Okay.
Right.
So who's eligible here? when we're thinking about multiples, who's eligible for this? Obviously, I think when people say twins, people think of identical twins, but really those aren't the only people you're looking for here, right?
Right. So the way the twin design works is by leveraging the difference between identical or monozygotic twins and fraternal or dizygotic twins. So fraternal twins share an average 50% of their genetic material. Monozygotic twins share 100%. And this is the crux of the twin design, is by looking at similarities between these different kinds of twins. And this includes, you know, opposite sex fraternal pairs, same sex fraternal pairs. And we are open to triplets and larger sets of multiples as well. So really any family with multiples who are age 17 and younger are eligible.
And how can people sign up?
We have a website. It's iltwins.com. So pretty simple URL to remember, I hope. And people can go and learn more about the project and about the various faculty affiliates across both Northwestern and Urbana-Champaign. And then there's also a sign-up form on there as well and a way to contact us with any questions.
How will people's information be used if they sign up for this, Jennifer?
So at this point, we're just establishing a database. The registry is not committing to participate in any specific project. By being in the database, as studies come up from us or our faculty affiliates, people will be contacted if they're eligible, and they'll then have the option to participate in the study or not. So there's no commitment at this stage. It's just saying, hey, I might be interested if a study comes up that we're eligible for.
And you're only looking for multiples, right? Like, you're not looking for siblings of multiples to register.
Not at this point, but that's a great question, because that is actually a really excellent research design as well. But at this point, we're just starting with the twins and other multiples.
Okay, well, we'll have that information up at 21stshow.org as well. But I want to thank Jennifer Tackett for being with us. Tell us a little bit more about this database that's being created, the Illinois Twins Project. She's an associate professor of psychology at Northwestern. Again, this is a project between Northwestern and U of I. Jennifer, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much.
People in the southern Illinois town of Herrin have lovingly adopted Porkchop the Pig as their unofficial town mascot. She has been running around Herrin since January. In fact, this pig has proven so hard to capture, both her owner and animal control have given up trying. Lucky for Porkchop, people in Herrin have taken to her. She has a fan page on Facebook with more than 2,000 members. Maddie Holden is well acquainted with Porkchop. Maddie's an animal control officer in Herrin. It's about 20 minutes east of Carbondale. Hi, Maddie. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Maddie, I think people might be under the impression that a pig running loose might be a problem for an animal control officer. But actually, that's not the case. You guys are fans of Porkchop, right?
Well, we are now. It was an issue there at the beginning. And then once we realized that there wasn't, you know, too much we could do once she got to a certain size, we just all kind of decided, you know, let's just let it be, take care of her.
How big has she gotten in her freedom then? I don't know what size she started at in January and how big she is now.
I'm not good with measurements myself, but I've heard a lot of people throw around the number of being around 300 pounds. So pretty big.
Wow. And do we know how she got loose in the first place? Maddie? Looks like we've lost Maddie there for a second. We're going to try to get her back here as we're talking about this big pork chop. She is on the loose in Heron, Illinois. It's about 20 minutes east of Carbondale. Pork Chop has her own Facebook page, and she's a hashtag Keep Pork Chop Free. So let's try to get Maddie back on the line here, and we can finish up this conversation with her. Okay, we've got Maddie Holden back on the line with us. Hey, Maddie, so I was asking you just before we lost you, do we know how Pork Chop got loose to begin with?
We're not exactly sure on the origin of how she got out, but I do know that at one point, whenever she was quite little still, back in, I want to say maybe January or February, a couple city officials, no animal control officers actually, just some, you know, people that work with the city, managed to corral her in some sort of little pen where she is, where she stays, actually. But whenever they went to grab her and move her to a transport vehicle, she slipped out of their hands, and she's been on the run ever since.
And so do people see her around town? I understand the Facebook page is people posting pictures of seeing her around town.
Absolutely. It's become quite an activity around here to go pig spotting. We'll still get the occasional call of somebody that doesn't know about her, but for the most part, people have made it just a town hobby to attract the pig, to get pictures of the pig, to let their dogs play with the pig. It's a big thing around here right now.
And so dogs are playing with Pork Chop as well? Just, it sounds like Pork Chop has a lot
yes.
of both human and animal friends?
Yes, I'd say more animal friends, because she's skittish about people. She won't let you pet her or anything. She is a wild animal. But dogs, she likes. She has this best friend named Harley. I'm sure that many people have heard about Harley. It's a black lab that lives over around the 8th Street somewhere with the pig. And they're seen running around together quite a bit. A lot of people take their dogs to the dog park where she hangs out for some reason.
Oh, so she hangs out at the dog park too. Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
She'll hang out around the park, and there's a little dog park next to it. So kind of all goes together, and the dogs will go and play with her and just run around.
So I mentioned there's a hashtag that's Keep Pork Chop Free. Has there been any discussion about what you guys are going to do? I mean, I saw on the Facebook page someone saying, I hope no one's trying to rescue this pig. She's happy being out on her own. As someone who's an animal control officer, I guess, do you guys just feel like this is a situation where you just got to let it go for now?
Well, the issue with it is we would catch her, because as cute as it is to have a city pig, it is a liability. You know, we don't want that pig to get hit on the highway. We don't want that animal hurt, let alone another human hurt, because of what an animal that big would do if somebody were to hit them. So it is kind of a cause for concern, and we have tried to catch it before, but at this point, it's so big that we're going to have a trap actually made for it, like an actual pig trap, and those are kind of costly, so we've kind of left it up to the people above us at this point to make the decision on how they're going to proceed, if they're going to proceed.
Well, and in the meantime, you guys are getting publicity from all over at least the U.S., right? I don't know if outside the U.S. as well, people asking you guys about Heron and about Pork Chop.
I've had a couple people do a couple interviews over it. Yeah, I was really shocked that this took off the way that it did.
All right. Well, Maddie,
I'm not sure where the farthest one is. But
thanks so much for taking the time to join us. We'll have plenty of pictures up on our social media, whether on Twitter or Facebook, if you would like to see Pork Chop in action. Maddie, thanks for taking the time to be with us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, guys. And everybody have a wonderful day.
Thanks, you too. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about eating and driving, more specifically, great road trip ideas with dining in mind, whether we're talking about Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Where do you like to go that has great eats that's just around us? You can send us ideas. The number to leave a voicemail for us is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. And we're going to be talking about that tomorrow on the program. Our Twitter handle, I mentioned, it's 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. We're not on air. You can catch us for the latest in Illinois news, so follow us there. Our Facebook page is another way to communicate with us if you search for the 21st to like us. All those links, every other way to contact us. I mentioned voicemails if you want to send us an email. Find our phone number for texting. You can just go to 21stshow.org. That's also where we've got all of our past shows. You can also find us on most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, iTunes, NPR One. Search for the 21ST. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. We also wanted to say a special thank you to our intern, Bobby McSwine. Today's her last day, and she graduates from the U of I this Saturday. Bobby, congratulations, and thank you so much for all your great work with us. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. And I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.